Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. It's an okay place to live if you don't breathe the air or drink the water. Cynical advice once given to tourists traveling abroad may now apply to domestic life. While some say our water is better than anywhere in the world, others say test before you drink. And a forceful approach to gardening and the Great Salt Lake.
The aesthetic value of the Great Salt Lake, being out in the middle of barren alkali flats with thousands of birds flying around you and snow-capped mountains in the background. It's one of the most beautiful areas I've ever worked at.
But are we creating North America's own Dead Sea? The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont. Call 1-800-CAR-HERE. And by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. During the Great Flood of 93, several key water treatment plants were knocked out by the raging Mississippi River. Citizens in the area, Des Moines, Iowa, and St. Joseph, Missouri, were without clean drinking water. Earlier in the spring, we sat up and took notice when a massive epidemic swept through the water in Milwaukee. Cryptosporidium felled thousands to a flu-like illness. Many died. The story has been repeated since in other communities in Carrollton County, Georgia, in Gastonia, North Carolina, and New York City. In fact, a recent massive report issued by the Natural Resources Defense Council is titled, Think Before You Drink. Other reports have appeared as well in recent editions of Time magazine and the environmental journal Garbage. It was after the flood episodes this summer that Jerry Tone, president of National Testing Laboratories, began to speak out. NTL, based in Cleveland, Ohio, is the nation's largest independent water testing lab. Tone says our drinking water supply may be contaminated by at least three very poisonous substances.
The presence of elements such as arsenic, which is contributed by just by the land itself, has risen as a major contaminant. There were some studies done in California relating to that, and then in addition, just the very addition of chlorine to water supplies, which significantly reduces the possibility of bacterial contamination, increases the possibility of the formation of trihalomethanes, which are themselves carcinogenic.
Lead is also found coming from the pipes leading to and in and around our house, lead in the pipes or in the solder used in the fittings. But citing the example of the state of Ohio alone, Tone says there is another source of this deadly poison in our drinking glass.
In the state of Ohio, we have about 300,000 buried fuel tanks. These are tanks which hold gasoline and or diesel fuel or heating oil. And some are abandoned, some are still in use. But in any event, somewhere in between 20 and 25 or 30 years, those eventually leak and it spills into the sand or into the ground surrounding the tank, whatever's in the tank, and the water as it passes down through the soil to get to the aquifer dissolves the gasoline or the fuel oil into benzene, toluene, xylenes, and that sort of thing. And they are carcinogenic. And we just didn't look for those until the passage of the Safe Drinking Water Act.
This congressional legislation from the 1970s is up for renewal, which accounts in part for the renewed interest in the quality of our drinking water at this time. The original act targeted industrial discharge and, says Tone, has done a fairly good job controlling this type of pollution. What the act does not do, however, is address these other, more insidious sources of pollution. We'll hear more from Jerry Tone in a moment, but first, are we right to be concerned, and is there a panic factor here? No. And no, says Joan Dent of the American Waterworks Association. The association, based in Denver, represents water treatment facilities. She says we in America drink some of the finest water in the world.
There has been a regulation, the Safe Drinking Water Act, which basically sets standards for the safety of public water that comes out of the tap. And that has actually been in effect since 1974. So even though most people may not know this, water suppliers have been working sort of behind the scenes in testing the water and making sure that it meets the federal standards, and also in putting in new treatment technologies. But what has happened is that we can now detect traces of substances at incredibly small levels. Like some things we can detect at like a part per trillion.
But if we could not see these agents before, neither were we getting sick and dying. The citizens in Milwaukee may not have been able to see the cryptosporidium, but they were very sick indeed. What about the charges that the laws on the books are fine as long as they are enforced, which they are not, and as a result, many treatment facilities are becoming lax in their standards and testing? Dent defends the system.
Some of the, actually, the cryptosporidium outbreak in Milwaukee, I think one of the controversies right now on the Safe Drinking Water Act, is that cryptosporidium is not something that utilities were required to monitor and treat for. Basically, there's not a regulation for that. So that was not a matter of the utility being, out of compliance with the regulation. However, there are utilities that have been testing for it and treating for it. So that the Milwaukee case is a very, very unfortunate one where climatic conditions and more turbidity in the water, and it's just a very, very unfortunate case of a lot of things coming together to make that happen.
Dent acknowledges there are statistics on the books that list certain facilities in certain communities as being out of compliance. She faults the system for not distinguishing degree. You stand in the checkout line designated for 7 or fewer items and you have 8 in your hands. The cashier will not let you through any more than the person who has a full shopping cart. A facility, says Dent, may be only a fraction over the limit on a given substance, and it is considered completely out of compliance. She also says facilities are required to test for substances regardless of geographical location, regardless of whether there is any chance at all of that substance showing up in the water in that region. Rather, she says, the law should be adapted to fit the particular needs of a particular region. Regardless of where you live and how clean you think your water is, Jerry Tone says chances are you are one of the 130 million Americans with lead in your water.
130 million Americans drink lead-contaminated water every day. This is a huge number. Our laboratory, we find lead in about 25% of all the drinking water samples that we analyze.
And as we mentioned before, the culprit is the pipes in your house or the solder fittings of those pipes. Citizens of rural communities or houses in the country ought to test for lead as well. To correct the situation, Tone says, you can and should do one of two things. Filter it out of your drinking water by using a filter at the tap, or you can and should replace the offending pipes. If you suspect the source is outside your house, Tone suggests contacting your local water board or the health department or both. The same goes for the other contaminants. You cannot correct a problem until you know it exists and know its source. So before you wet your whistle the next time with a tall glass of water, or even steam your vegetables, stop, look, test. This is Bruce Robertson. You remember that dairy product commercial a few years back warning us that, quote, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature? Well, Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, considers himself a nice person, not one to do bad deeds, at least not knowingly. In fact, he argues that in this age of heightened environmental awareness, it goes without saying that we all should be living in consonance with the ways of Mother Nature. But Larry says there is a fun and harmless way to fool around, and, well... Okay, let's see if Larry's home. He said he's going to do some planting of flowers, but he's indoors here. Let's see. Hey, Larry.
Ruth, is that you?
You home, Larry?
I am. I'm out here in my sunroom.
Your sunroom?
Yeah, I'm out here in my... This is where I like to plant up all my stuff. Whether I'm transplanting indoor stuff or working with my houseplants, I like to bring everything in here to the sunroom.
I know you said you were going to do some planting, but I sort of assumed you'd be planting outdoors. But you've got everything laid out here. What's happening?
Well, I'm planting bulbs for indoors. I'm going to be forcing a lot of bulbs, a lot of Holland bulbs, that we normally have come up in the spring. Well, these are going to come up in the spring, but I'm going to grow them indoors and force them and kind of push them into blooming a little prematurely.
So tell me what you're doing.
Well, first of all, I've planted up all the bulbs. There's two ways to force bulbs. because there's two different types. This is, these are the paper white hyacinths. Now these I just plant in a container. This is a plastic container about 4 inches high. You fill it about halfway with potting soil. That's what I have here, a potting mix. And you just put them down in there. I've got about five or six of them in about a 6-inch wide pot. And then make sure you place them with the pointy tip up and the roots down. And then you just cover those up with some more of this mixture, just so their little tips are pointing out.
Mm-hmm.
And you just push that down and just a little bit like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then naturally give them a real good drink of water. Now with these, I'm going to start forcing these right away. And only the paper whites you can do that with. I'm going to just put them in a nice cool room and start giving them light, and they're going to start growing. And in about 6 to 8 weeks, I'm going to have daffodils blooming. So right in the dead of winter, I'm going to have daffodils blooming in my house, and it's going to be absolutely beautiful. So let me move this over.
That's one style.
That's one style. Now here's the other style. This I have a terracotta pot about the same height, about 4 to 5 inches tall and about 6 to 7 inches in diameter. We don't want a real deep pot. We want a shallow, kind of a flat, squat pot.
Is there any difference between using the plastic pot and the terracotta
pot?
Okay.
No, there's no difference, at all.
Okay, so in this case, you just happen to be using the terracotta.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are you doing?
Now, and then I put some other types of daffodils. These are ordinary King Alfred yellow daffodils that would normally go outside. I've planted these already where I filled it up halfway, put them in there, covered them up, just so the little tips are sticking out. And now I've done the same with hyacinths, tulips, and crocuses. I've done the same with all of those. And now I'm going to water those very deeply, and then I'm going to take those down to the basement. Or if I had an attached garage, an unheated garage, I would put them in there. Because they need to go through a chilling period of about 12 to 14 weeks. They need to go downstairs so it's pretend winter for them into a cold area. Some people use a refrigerator, an unused refrigerator, and just put them in there. But then next spring, after this 12 or 14 weeks goes by, I'll bring those upstairs and expose them to a little bit of light, and then I'll have more beautiful daffodils and tulips and everything else blooming next spring.
Well, it's a beautiful way to continue your outdoor garden indoors.
That's right.
And apparently this is not harming them by forcing them.
No, because then after they've done their forcing, then you can take the bulbs outside, plant them, right, you know, next spring after everything else is dead, plant them, and then the following spring they'll come back. Then they'll bloom again, so you can always put these back outside. But it's a great way to keep gardening all winter long. It's a lot of fun to watch them come up, and it's beautiful. It makes the house beautiful in color and in fragrance.
And cheering up in the middle of the winter.
That's right.
Well, Larry, I look forward to seeing them bloom, and come by sometime when they're in bloom, or let me know. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks for coming by.
Bye-bye. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens, His Methods of Gentle Persuasion, work wonders around his home in Hollowville, New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. The Golden Spike, uniting the Central Pacific and the Union Pacific Railroads, was driven at Promontory Point, near the north shore of the Great Salt Lake. The year was 1869. Today, the Salt Lake City area of Utah is among the fastest-growing regions in the nation. Lake-effect snow in the rugged Rockies make it one of the winter sports meccas of the world. This, along with low crime rates, a pleasant climate, and a strong industrial base, draw new residents from all corners of the continent and worldwide. The lake itself is one of the reasons people come. The surviving remnant of a much larger body, Lake Bonneville, that at one time 16,000 years ago covered half the state of Utah and stretched north into Idaho. The lake, the Great Salt Lake, today is about 80 kilometers long by 100 kilometers wide. And with rivers running in but not running out, the lake is indeed a salty lake, the world's largest saline lake.
If you were to look at the ocean, the ocean is about 3% salinity, and the Great Salt Lake can be as high as 24% salinity.
Peter Payton is a doctoral graduate student at Utah State University and part of a research team working on the National Biological Survey with the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service. The high salinity is fun to float in if you are a swimmer. However, it supports a very limited range of organisms. In the water lives a unique brine shrimp. Along the shores live the brine fly. These, along with shorebird species, comprise the biological diversity of the region. Payton says even though the diversity is limited, the lake is critical to the health of the planet.
That's extremely important because especially for migratory birds, which I'm interested in, because there's so much food there, the brine shrimp and the brine flies and some other organisms too, many thousands, tens of thousands of birds stop here to nourish themselves, to migrate further north or south, depending on if it's spring or fall.
If you consult any wildlife migratory map, you will see that all flyways between North and South America along the West Coast pass through the Salt Lake area. Peyton says the Great Salt Lake is especially critical to the snowy plover. The world's largest concentration of snowy plovers can be found on Great Salt Lake.
About 10,000 birds. There's as many snowy plovers around the Great Salt Lake as there are in California, Oregon, and Nevada, and Washington combined. And because the Great Basin Desert is such a dynamic ecosystem, lakes and ponds are constantly either getting filled up with water or evaporating. Things are always changing here, and so at certain points in time, certain lakes become very important to a lot of shorebirds. When there's a lot of food around, there's a lot of water, then the shorebirds use that area. So at this point in time right now, Great Salt Lake is being used by more avocets and stilts, which are two large shorebirds, than anywhere else in the Great Basin Desert. It could be over time that eventually the lake will recede to the point or either get flooded out so the habitat isn't available and the shorebirds will use other lakes scattered throughout the Great Basin Desert. As more and more of these lakes throughout the Great Basin Desert get eaten up by development, agricultural use of the water, so the water is no longer that ecosystem, there's few and few refuges for these birds to concentrate on, given the dynamic nature of the area. And so over time, as we develop the Great Basin Desert, the Great Salt Lake becomes more and more important.
In 1903, Southern Pacific Railroad constructed a wooden piling trestle across the middle of the lake. This was replaced by a rock and earthen dike in 1959. The northern part of the lake was thus cut off from the southern section. In time, with no freshwater rivers flowing in, the northern part has become much saltier than the southern lake. In 1984, a 300-foot hole was blasted in this dike to allow water to exchange. Effects are being monitored. Meanwhile, the southern section is also becoming saltier than it used to be, as the three major freshwater rivers emptying into the southern lake are diverted for industry and agriculture. Alice Lindell, professor of biology at Utah State University in Logan, says the increasing salinity is not the only cause for alarm.
There are also pressures due to pollution, mainly heavy metals, by industries in the Salt Lake Valley. A lot of effluent goes into the lake from industry, and the thing that's of particular concern is that that lake is not flushed out. It's a terminal lake. There's no exit to the sea to wash the toxics out to the sea, where I guess they would accumulate eventually as well. But everything bioaccumulates in these terminal basins, so that if we have heavy metals like cadmium and mercury, those sorts of things, those will just accumulate in the food chain. And the brine shrimp, I don't know about the brine flies, but the brine shrimp are quite capable of handling heavy toxic loads, but they'll pass on that toxic load to the birds. And nobody has any idea how much of that is going on right now.
So what are the issues? Tom Wharton is an editor of the Salt Lake Tribune and author of a series of special articles and a comprehensively researched tabloid on the lake and the issues affecting it.
Well, the Great Salt Lake is regarded by a lot of Utah residents as nothing more than a sump and a smelly pond where industry has traditionally dumped its refuse, its effluents into the lake. And so locally, the Great Salt Lake isn't held in especially high regard. So there are a lot of threats to the lake. For example, Davis County to the north of Salt Lake County would like to create a giant freshwater lake out of an arm of the Great Salt Lake out of Farmington Bay. A freshwater lake would change the ecology of it drastically if some very nice natural salt marshes have been preserved by the Nature Conservancy. There are mineral companies that go in and try to mine the brine for various minerals, primarily potassium and magnesium and salt. they're expanding their operation, which has an effect on the ecosystem of the lake. There are brine shrimp. The brine shrimp industry is a $30 million industry, and there are brine shrimpers that go out and take millions and millions of brine shrimp eggs, and there are enough brine shrimp that the brine shrimpers say, hey, we're not hurting anything, but there really hasn't been enough known about the lake to know whether that's having an effect or not on the ecology of the lake. There are the routing of highways and the routing of railroads and transportation systems. For example, the Salt Lake International Airport is adding a third runway, which is impacting to a great extent some wetlands just west of Salt Lake City. They're having to do a massive mitigation project to replace those wetlands in a different area, but there is some concern that you can't replace a natural salt marsh. So industry is attacking the Great Salt Lake, and because it doesn't have a real natural constituency of people that really think that, hey, this is a neat and special place, the public is pretty apathetic about whether it's worth it to save these salt marshes, which most of them will call as mud flats, or you'll hear all kinds of derogatory names for them.
Tom, let me ask you another angle on this, and it's a little bit delicate, I guess, to discuss, but I'm sure it's a factor that you consider and that is considered whenever the issues are raised and the solutions are proposed. What is the role of the Mormon Church, and not only as a political body, but as individual members of the Mormon Church? What is their what seems to be the position and the role of the church and the people in either advancing these problems or finding solutions to them?
A roundabout way to maybe answer your question is the local culture is that resources are to be used, whether you're talking about the public lands for cattle mining or timber, whether you're talking like an asset of the Great Salt Lake. They tend to look for something of value out of it. That tends to be the local culture.
Tom Wharton speaking to us from the busy editorial room of the Salt Lake Tribune. Peter Payton says for him, the lake has more than scientific value. Perhaps this is one reason many of us, too, are drawn to this great salty lake.
Well, I've worked in a lot of different ecosystems. I've worked in the old-growth redwood forests of Northern California. I've worked in tropical rainforests in Hawaii. I grew up in Colorado, so I grew up in the mountains of Colorado. But the aesthetic value of the Great Salt Lake, being out in the middle of barren alkali flats with thousands of birds flying around you and snow-capped mountains in the background. It's one of the most beautiful areas I've ever worked at in the world. And it's an incredibly serene environment. It's just a nice, calm place to work.
Nearly everyone we spoke with in researching this piece agrees. The lake is in crisis, but not beyond the point of no return. The biggest factor contributing to the crisis is lack of public knowledge or concern about the lake's importance as an ecological habitat. They say those especially from the east and west coasts who flock to the region for the skiing and the resorts have no idea that their presence is creating an economy that in turn is creating the crisis that may, in the end, destroy the very reason both residents, tourists, and industry are there in the first place. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. Thanks much for joining us, and be sure to tune in next week at this same time for another edition. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for the Environment Show, program number 203. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. We had help this week from Tracy O'Connell. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont. Call 1-800-CARHERE.